All right. England, no religious civil wars. But religion would be brought to England when the Catholics would attempt to reestablish dominance in the tiny island kingdom. The first significant attempt to occur during Elizabeth's reign were brought on by her cousin and heir, Mary, Queen of Scots, but she failed miserably and lost her head in the process. But she got the ball rolling by contacting the Pope, because the Pope did receive some word. But most of his reaction was infuriated when he learned that a Catholic queen, yes, she was deposed, she was no longer a sovereign, but she still was a Catholic queen, had been killed by a Protestant. That motivated the Pope to reach out to someone else who had a claim. Philip II of Spain. Have any of you ever heard of the concept of unity? In terms of relationships, unity in terms of relationships. All right, back in the day, and it wasn't even that long ago, when, and it's still kind of true today, I guess, when a man marries a woman, they are not viewed in the eyes of God, nor in the eyes of the law, as being separate beings. Rather, they are seen as a couple. They have been united. Which technically means whatever he had becomes hers, and whatever she had becomes his. And that lasts in perpetuity. So just because death do us part, that does not eliminate the claim over the possessions of the one that you were in a union with. That being said, who or from where does Philip get the claim? Philip, who is the king of England? The king of Spain, get the right to claim England, the English throne?
Mary.
Which Mary?
Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary. Philip, the king of Spain, literally was married to Elizabeth's older sister, who preceded her to the throne. Was their union legit? 100%. They got married in the eyes of God and in the church. They consummated their union. The only thing was is that after they did the consummation, Philip went back to Spain to rule his kingdom. Now, 20 years later, he's turning around and saying, no, I want what is mine by right. Does he have any other areas for claim? Interesting, he does. Because he is the great nephew of Catherine, Henry's first wife, who was Mary's mother. So yeah, he married a cousin. But there are still two lines of claim, regardless. And, in the eyes of the Catholic Church, the Pope says, go get it. Now, here's the irony. Neither side is innocent in this. Because, as we talked about, one of the reasons why up until the English explorers that took place late in Elizabeth's reign, one of the reasons why there was no interest in making colonies is because the English had been engaging in piracy with privateers.
So Elizabeth had been sending her pirates out, and they had been capturing Spanish ships. Well, in retaliation, Philip had plotted against Elizabeth.
And he engaged in a couple of assassination attempts,
trying to encourage a couple of coups in his own right. So both were messing with one another, trying to topple the other. But the icing on the cake came when the Pope says, take her out. So, with the Pope's blessing, Philip uses the wealth of Spain and builds one of the largest fleets assembled at that time, the Spanish Armada. DNA is covered by the picture, which for some reason is a little over to the left as opposed to on the right line, but it is what it is. Armada. 130 ships. 25,000 men. And by the way, there were both Spanish and French soldiers in the Armada. Because as we said previously, Philip was an ally of De Guise, who himself was a Catholic, who wanted to topple Protestant monarchs. But when the Armada launched from the French coastline, aimed at crossing the English Channel, to put forward a landing operation, an invasion, does anyone know what happened? The damn English wind. A storm erupted in the channel. By the way, that's very, still occurs today, very frequently. Though, because of the way the topography between France and England, the English Channel itself, storms have a tendency to, you know, get riled up in the twisting air mass.
So just as the Spanish fleet launches from France, begins crossing the channel, this big storm erupts and the seas become rough. So what was the solution to those situations back in the day? Well, you take as many ships as possible and you tie them together to make it a bigger mass, to make the individual ships kind of protecting one another. But then the English did something unprecedented, which is the reason why John White was not able to get back to Roanoke for 2 years. The Queen ordered a seizure of all ships in England, and many of the smaller ships were loaded with wood and hay and tar and pitch and set on fire and sailed directly at this big mass of Spanish ships that were all tied together. Roughly one-third of the ships caught on fire and sunk, which meant roughly one-third of the men were lost at sea.
It was so catastrophic that when the seas died down, the Spanish had to pull back. Philip had intended on building a second armada, but he never was able to get enough free cash to afford to build another fleet. So in the end, his attempt to bring Catholicism failed because of an act of God. But here is the most amazing thing. And this ultimately is what allowed Elizabeth to put a final nail in the Catholic versus Protestantism dispute in England. She rallied everybody by doing the enemy of my enemy is my friend. She simply put it forth. Look, I don't care if you are Protestant or if you are Catholic. If you are English, your mortal enemy is the Spanish. And they're coming to enslave you. Do you want to be enslaved by the Spanish? And this, in part, is one of the reasons why, as I mentioned, At the outset, when I mentioned her, she is regarded as one of the most beloved monarchs in the entire, bless you, history of England. Because she brought the nation together. Questions? Oh, if only I had 10 minutes, I would have done that last class. We're good? Tens of thousands. Well, we'll say thousands died there. Mostly Spanish.
But hands down, the most epic of all of the wars of religion
was the 30 Years' War. And this goes back to a question that Ernest asked last class, I believe. Or maybe it was the class before. And it impacted whose rule, whose religion. What happens if you're a Catholic realm and then suddenly you get a Protestant king?
Well, the most detrimental, the most catastrophic of all the European wars of religion once again involved the Habsburgs. The family that controlled Austria, Central Europe, and today what we mostly call Germany, Northern Italy, and Spain, and the New World.
The Habsburgs. The family of Charles V.
Charles, after getting his butt whipped and exhausted, dealing with Maurice of Saxony, and then the French, and then the Turks. In 1556, he retired. And would spend the last few years of his life in relative seclusion.
But when he retired, he did something somewhat extraordinary. Instead of doing what Roman emperors would do, trying to basically pass on the intact empire to continue the expansion and growth of the empire, he decided the only way to save the empire is to divide the empire. He severed Spain and its New World Empire from Austria in the central part of Europe. To Spain, he gave to his son, the aforementioned Philip II. Who took the throne when he was still in his teens, and to Austria and Northern Italy, and the central part of Europe called the Holy Roman Empire, he gave that to his brother, who was crowned Ferdinand I. For 50 years, from the end of the Wars of Charles all the way up until the 1610s, these two new kingdoms were constant allies and always worked in unison. Which, of course, gave each strength in their own right. So what does this mean? Well, if the Spanish needed help, they sent German soldiers. Or if the Austrians needed help, they sent Spanish soldiers. Fast forward to the reign of Ferdinand II, who is the Holy Roman Emperor. He was not interested in the toleration that culminated at the end of the Wars of Charles. He was not interested in the pacifism of his grandfather Ferdinand, nor his father Maximilian II. And part of the reason why is he was educated by the Jesuits. He got a pure Catholic Counter-Reformation education. And in this intolerant view, he was allied with Philip IV, who, interestingly enough, was his nephew. So, looking around at the way the wars of Charles ended with the Treaty of Augsburg, which gave full legal status to Lutherans and full toleration of any Protestant faith, Ferdinand and Philip were committed to implementing a Catholic counter-reformation. They dreamed of restoring Catholicism to the entire European continent. Bless you. But they needed opportunity. And as it turns out, in 1619, opportunity came a knocking. When there was a death on the throne of the Kingdom of Bohemia. Bohemia had been a Hussite kingdom, which technically was still in union with the Catholic Church, although they were allowed to practice their own modified views. Well, problem was, is that the Hussite king had died and he had no direct descendant. So the Bohemian nobles reached out, looked around the family tree, and they found a relative, and they elected him to become king. And he was crowned Frederick V of the northern German state of Palatine. Now here's the catch. Frederick was not a Hussite. Thus he was not a Catholic. But instead, he was a Calvinist. And he also was the son-in-law of James I of England. So meaning, he was a Protestant with a Protestant ally. Well, when Ferdinand hears about this, he saw this as the opportunity. Because this would impact, cuius regio, eos religio. Because based on the Treaty of Augsburg, this now means Bohemia, by default, is going to become a Calvinist state. So Ferdinand sees an opportunity, provokes civil war. He managed to stir up resistance by promising the nobles who would be loyal to him more land, more rights, more privileges. But the problem is the peasants, who were the majority of the people. They were pure Hussites, which technically is kind of like a Protestant. And they were willing to listen to some of the Calvinist ideas because Hussism, due to the influence of Wycliffe, kind of thought the idea of predestination kind of fit Scripture. So they were kind of down with a lot of the ideas. They were also down with the strict rules, the social rules that were being implemented in the Calvinist areas by combining church and state. And they also like the localized control. So the church in your town, which is part of your town government, may set a certain rules that may be different than the rules in the town next door, but that's fine. So long as the focus is on the behaviors and belief of the people. So not only did you have a Catholic versus Protestant battle, you also had class warfare. So what happened? Simple. The majority of the peasants sided with the Protestant nobles and rallied behind the king that they elected, Frederick. But the Catholic nobles didn't care what the peasants want and instead allied with the emperor, who brought in Austrian and Spanish soldiers. Well, no offense to us dirty, stinking commoners, but how effective do you think we would be fighting against professional, trained army of soldiers? Particularly when there was no concept of the Second Amendment. The peasants were completely disarmed. Well, let's just say there was complete devastation. The Austrian and the Spanish armies rolled over everyone and everything. 3/4 of the towns were completely destroyed. The Catholics attacked both the Hussites and the Calvinists, and any Lutherans that got in the way. They burned farms. They burned fields. They killed livestock. It was estimated that 2.2 million Bohemians would be killed in this all-out attempt to implement what, by today's standards, could be considered a genocide. Well, here's the thing. Once word spread of what the Spanish and the Austrians were doing, it triggered immediate response globally, well, in and around Europe. And this isolated attack suddenly became an international war. The reason being, yes?
When they devastated Bohemia, did they get to Frederick?
He fled. He ended up he barely escaped and barely got to England in the safety of his father-in-law. Like, there was one story where he was put on a barge and had the barge left the dock to go downstream. Just 5 minutes later, they would have captured him. All right. Now, the Habsburgs use their success to basically say, okay, we know how to bring back Catholicism by killing them all. You kill all the Lutherans. You kill all the Protestants. You kill all the Calvinists. And let God sort them out. Over and over again, there was a complete violation of the Treaty of Augsburg in land after land after land. And in the process, there was just violence. There wasn't all battles. There wasn't all burning everything down. But they used economic warfare. They used political pressure. They used assassinations. And they used outright invasions. And just as the pendulum was moving in the direction of the Catholics, the other states sat back and said, well, if we allow them, the Habsburgs, to win, we're going to be next. So as a result, Denmark to the north, Sweden even further north, and even France did the whole geopolitical thing, where they recognized that if the Habsburgs are completely successful in Germany, France could be next. Denmark could be next. The Scandinavian countries could be next. So they joined forces and they got into the fray. England also got involved. But they did not send troops. They sent money, they sent ships, they sent weapons. This went on for over a decade. And then it went into the second decade. Issue after issue, incident after incident, battle after battle, death on an unfathomable scale, destruction never seen before in European times. Until, out of sheer luck, 1643, the French did a move that the Spanish didn't anticipate. Instead of fighting a battle just in the Holy Roman Empire, France actually invaded Spain, which caused the Spanish to have to quickly retreat. And by the time the Spanish soldiers got back, they were exhausted. And the French smashed their army, which effectively knocked the Spanish out of the war. And with the Spanish gone, the Austrians were left on their own. And in 1645, a Swedish army crushed the Habsburgs at the Battle of Jankau, which was outside of Prague. Well, after this defeat, knowing that Spain was out, the new emperor, Ferdinand III, saw the writing on the wall. So in 1648, he officially declared an end to the wars that were started by his father. When representatives from the Protestant states and those foreign kingdoms all traveled to the city of Westphalia and they signed a treaty. The Treaty of Westphalia. And guess what it was based on? Curius regeo, eos religio. Now here's why I'm laughing. In a wicked, sarcastic, almost sinister way. 30% of the German population was slaughtered in this war today known as the 30 Years' War. 7.5 million out of an estimated population of 21 million. Now, FYI, by comparison, our most destructive war in our nation's history, the Civil War, we only saw a death rate, soldiers and civilians, of 1 out of every 100 people that were alive. So we're talking 10%. They suffered 30%. To say that the German economy was shattered, that's an understatement. And by the way, it was devastated so bad, that's the reason why the Holy Roman Empire could never fuse together and become a single country. And they wouldn't do it until 1870 because of so much destruction that was done during this time period. It also eliminated Spain's global power status. Up until the 30 Years' War, you could argue that they were the superpower. No more after that. Their economy was shattered and they were bankrupt. Because by the 30 Years' War, they weren't taking gold and silver out. of the Inca lands anymore. Those mines had dried up. Yes, they were still getting the food. They were still getting the cash crops. But the market rate of pure gold versus, you know, some yams, you know, it's kind of like this. This war also saw a transformation in the nature of warfare. For the first time, entire armies were mobilized with firearms. And the vast majority of the soldiers used were mercenaries. But what this did was shatter once and for all the dream of recreating ancient Rome. Because this would leave Europe fragmented, as it still is today. Because had the Habsburgs been successful, there would not have been a France and an England and a Scotland and an Ireland and a Portugal and Denmark and all the other. They would have just, the Habsburgs would have probably merged the thrones. One of the two emperors would have given up to the other one, and they would have become, you know, a sole emperor ruling over a unified European state. The last consequence that I want to share was this was the last time that Europeans put religion at the forefront of war. Because even the most fanatical sat back and said, yeah, it's really not worth trying to kill them all because of how they interpret scripture. Let's do the live and let live thing. Question. The Turks did not attempt to invade during the 30 Years' War because at this point the Ottomans were fighting a war with another Muslim kingdom called the Safavids, which controlled modern Afghanistan. So had they not been doing that, they might have tried getting involved. But instead of looking towards Europe, they were looking the other way. Yes?
What were the terms of the treaty?
Curius regeo, eius religio. Whose rule, his religion. So if you lived in a Protestant kingdom and your king was Protestant, your religion would be Protestant. But here's the funny thing. Within a generation, even the most Catholic kings basically started saying, yeah, if you want to be a Protestant and you want to live in my kingdom, that's fine. Just pay your taxes. Any other questions?
Also, what was the language situation like during the wars and all of that?
Language?
Yeah.
The international language at this time was, it wasn't French yet. I think they were still communicating in Latin.
So a lot of all these nations.
But the people spoke different German dialects, different Spanish dialects. By the way, that was a problem. Now that I think about it, the Spanish Habsburg soldiers actually could not talk to the German Habsburg soldiers. Because the Spanish spoke Spanish and the German spoke German. But the commanding officers, they largely did their communication in Latin. It would be after this war, though, that French would begin to rise, and that would become the international language. All the way up until the 19th century when English took over. And now today, the language of internationalism is American. Well, not exaggerating. I'm not exaggerating. Do you think the diplomats speaking the king's English?
No.
We speak American. All right. The last unit for exam number 3, state building. State building. The control of the church has weakened. Christianity in Europe has fractured. And as we said, religion was no longer the primary focus. At the same time, the quest for more, 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 caused an economic transformation in the kingdoms of Europe in the 16th century. Sorry, 17th century, 1600s. So what started happening is the monarchs all across the continent started taking advantage of the fact that the noble class had suffered devastation. The peasant class was basically just the peasants. And it provided the kings an opportunity to take greater control. But every single European kingdom did it slightly different. Because we don't have time to talk about every single European kingdom, I'm going to follow the path that almost every single Western Civ textbooks uses. Instead of dealing with them all, we're going to look at the bookends. One kingdom would become the most centralized, and the other would become the least. I'm not telling you which one is which, but we're going to start off with England. And this rise towards modernity began upon the death of the Virgin Queen on March 24th, 1603. The second most popular monarch in English history died after serving on the throne for 45 years. But as we said a couple of times, she was known as the Virgin Queen for a reason. She never got married, and she never had kids. Now, was she an actual virgin? Don't know. But I don't think she would allow herself to be called the Virgin Queen had she been otherwise. Although I suppose the slutty queen doesn't work. But that was Mary, Queen of Scots. So now we have the monarch dead with no children. Oh no, are we going to result in a 100 years war? Well, fortunately no, because England already had a law on the books. The Act of Succession that was passed by Elizabeth's father. Way back in 1543. It's almost as if Henry foresaw. He said his son would be the first ruler. Edward. We know he came to the throne as a kid. He died of tuberculosis before he had an heir. Then under the Act of Succession it would go to Mary. Bloody Mary came to the throne. She ruled for 6 years, but she never produced an heir. She had a false pregnancy, but that wasn't a real pregnancy. And then it went to Elizabeth. 45 years. Not too shabby. But what happens if Elizabeth has no heir? Well, Henry already said it. It's to go to the descendants of his sister. His younger sister, Margaret, had been married off by Henry and Margaret's father, Henry VII, to James IV of Scotland. Her third son became James V, whose only legitimate heir was Mary, Queen of Scots, who abdicated in 1567 and was forced to go to England, where she was stupid and eventually got her head cut off. But when Mary, Queen of Scots, was pulled off the throne, she had a son, James, who would be put on the throne. And he would become James VI of Scotland, who is the legal heir. So at 37 years old, Parliament invited him to come to England and to be crowned another king, King of England. So, this means he is James I of England and James VI of Scotland. And he would be the founder of an offshoot of the Tudors, the Stuarts. Now, I'll be honest with you. I am a big fan of James. Not because he was the perfect king, but I'm a fan of James because he was an intelligent king. He focused on the one thing that all governments of any kind should do: being effective. He established an effective royal system in Scotland where he wielded enough power to maintain law and order, but he had good relations with the nobles. He was respectful of them. He listened to them. He heeded their advice. And he was protective of the people. So ironically, despite the fact that England killed his mother, when he came to England, he had no grudge. He had no axe to grind. Interestingly enough, when word of the Spanish Armada spread throughout the English islands, James actually contacted Elizabeth and said, "I'll send you Scottish troops if you want." Fortunately, there never was a need. So when he comes to the throne, he already knows what he's doing. And he brings that view to England. And by the way, he also decided to move his throne from Scotland to England. And upon his arrival, he had to deal with the fact that he simultaneously was the King of Scotland and the King of England, and being the King of England, that also meant you were the King of Wales and the King of Ireland. So what he decided to do, he was the first one to coin the phrase Great Britain in reference to his United Kingdom. Now here's the funny thing. Scotland accepted the title, but England did not. Because the English were racists. They viewed the Welsh and the Irish as just like as close to being primitive barbarians as you can get. And of course the English was so much superior than the Scottish as well. Christ, the Scots, they run around in those kilts, half naked, nothing underneath, letting the wind blow up and kind of causing cold shrinkage to their hoo-has. Eating haggis and all the other crazy things that those Scots do. So even though the king wanted to rule everything together, they still had separate parliaments. The English parliament focused on England, Wales, and Ireland, and the Scottish parliament focused on Scotland. But because he was experienced, and because the English, some members of Parliament, didn't necessarily trust him, and some annoyed him, he would attempt to do as much as he could as king. In other words, he didn't want to be controlled by Parliament. How could he get away with this? Well, he literally wrote a book on it, called The True Law of Free Monarchies. It's a fascinating little read in which he sets out the ideological base for what become known as absolute monarchy. Absolute monarchy. And it's based on a theory, and to use the phrase that he coined, he argued that kings have absolute authority because it's literally given to them by God. After all, if a man or a woman sits on the throne and is crowned, how do they get there?
And who determined that their family would be in that position of power? God did.
God controls everything. So it's God that decides whether there's who's going to be a king and who's not. So, because God is there, and by the way, Scripture does not mention popes, but Scripture does mention kings. And it's Scripture, even King David in the Old Testament, there's a recognition that kings are higher than men. Because God creates the kings to rule over men. Kings are called gods by the prophetical King David because they sit upon his throne that God gave them over the earth and have the count of their administration to give unto him. God makes a man king. God is entrusted with ruling over... God makes a man king, and the king is entrusted by God to rule over God's earthly kingdom. So as a result, the king should be able to do absolutely whatever he wants. He should have the power over all areas of policy. He should have the power over life and death. So, if the king wants to impose his rule, he can do so. Why? Because of God. But here's the catch. Can God, or will God, tolerate a tyrant? No. In his book, he states the actual limits of absolute authority. Tradition. Kings cannot change the culture, the traditions, the values of the people over which they rule. And two. You also cannot be violative of God's laws. Because if you ignore tradition, and if you ignore the will of God, you will, and I quote, stir up such scourges as pleaseth him for the punishment of wicked kings. Questions? I wish I could finish. I got 3 clicks left, but I'm not going to hold you late.
So we are going to come back on Monday. I got 3 last clicks to talk about James, and then we're going to talk about his son, who kind of did both, and then he triggered an English Civil War, and then we're going to see what happened after the Civil War. And then after we finish with that, we're going to go to France and see what France did. And then you're going to have your 3rd exam. Papers are due 1 week from today.